Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. At the end of this week, St. Louis will observe its semiquincentennial, or 250th anniversary of its founding. Historians still argue over the exact date, February 14th or 15th, but we have three renowned historians with us today to talk about the earliest days of St. Louis. I'm Don Marsh. Joining us in studio, Fred Fowles of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. He is the author of Founding St. Louis, First City of the New West. Peter Castor is professor of history at Washington University. He is the author of two books, William Clark's World, Describing America in an Age of Unknowns, and The Nation's Crucible, The Louisiana Purchase and the Creation of America. Jay Gitlin joins us from Yale University, where he teaches history. He is the author of The Bourgeois Frontier, French Towns, French Traders, and American Expansion. Thank you all so much for being with us today. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Fred, I'd like to start with you. Well, we've had much discussion on this program recently about the exact date of the founding, February 14th, February 15th. Now I read in getting ready for this program, there are some people out there who think it might be March. What's going on?
Well, Auguste Chouteau's handwriting was the cause of most of that. He clearly wrote the 15th. And he backed up his eyewitness documentation as one of the founders with testimony, much of it under oath, years later. So between roughly 1803 to 1825, he didn't change his story at all. And historians are like lawyers. Written evidence trumps hearsay, oral tradition. And the 15th is the founding date. And all scholarly historians in the last several years have taken the 15th.
How did March come into the equation?
March came in sometime probably after Auguste Chouteau died in 1829 when a family member tampered with it and wrote M-A-R-S, French for March, over his February. But we know it was February because of other documentation, other correspondence between New Orleans and Fort de Chartres officials. Mm-hmm. So it couldn't have been March. It, just like the someone allegedly in the Chouteau family in 1921 tampered with the tombstone of Auguste Chouteau, thinking that he couldn't have been 14 and did all that he did. So they made him 24, which meant that his mother gave birth to him at age 7.
All right, we're not going to buy that one. Then.
No,
I think it's safe to say that.
Chronology doesn't accept that.
I'd like to ask each of you gentlemen essentially the same question here and see what kind of a variety we get in the answers. And Peter, I'll start with you. What do you see as the most significant event of the early days of St. Louis?
It's hard to talk about a single event that comes to mind to me, but rather it's the day-to-day events that are going on, that day in, day out. St. Louis is one of these places that really embodies what is this distinctly American experience of pluralism and encounter. It's this town where that's founded by the French, it's governed by the Spanish, and Indians permit it to grow. And it really exemplifies the way that in early America, day in, day out, this multiracial, multinational population was trying not just to get along with each other, that makes it sound far too peaceful, but rather they're trying to sort out who's going to be in charge, what kind of rules are going to work. And St. Louis exemplified that as much as any other town or city in North America.
Jay Gitlin, same question to you. Do you take a different approach?
No, I agree with everything that people have said so far. but I would probably place some emphasis on the building of a family. To me, that's the fundamental event of early St. Louis is the growth of the Chouteau or Chouteau family. I tend to say Chouteau when I'm in St. Louis. I try to remember to say Chouteau. But I think it's the gathering of in-laws by the children of Madame Chouteau and the gathering of capital, both social capital, familial capital, and capital in terms of money and finances that results in the growth of the city and the growth of this family. So it's a family that really provides incredible leadership for St. Louis and does so for a remarkable period of time.
All right. Fred Fowles, same question to you.
Well, I think St. Louis is absolutely distinctive because of the It was an Indian capital, the center of Midwestern Indian diplomacy, at least 32 tribes every year. In one gathering, about 130 tribes showed up to receive presents, to give gifts to the Spanish commandant. And between the French merchants involved in the fur trade who were trying to do well and the Spanish commandants who were committed to doing good, the Indians were the beneficiaries. And that was the most significant difference from Anglo-American colonization in the Trans-Appalachian region, really from the East Coast to the Mississippi. And so the biggest losers after the Louisiana Purchase were Native American, Native nations.
Mm-hmm. But Peter Castro, I'd like to go back to something that you said. You talked about people thinking that it was a fairly peaceful society at that time. And that was certainly my impression, but you indicate it was not.
Well, there isn't widespread warfare in this region, and that's an important thing to bear in mind because the 18th century is really a century of warfare. The American Revolution is this event that Americans know about. But my point was simply to say that there is this notion that's emerged in different ways over time that it is this very peaceful gathering of everyone getting along well in St. Louis. The way I would suggest it is that you've got several different groups of people coming to this place all struggling for advantage. I think Fred put it really well. Indians permitted St. Louis to be founded and to grow, and they see this as a place where they can pursue their commercial advantage. And then the French merchants and traders see it in exactly the same way. So, and they don't really see it as a benefit to go to war. That comes later. But even though there isn't outright warfare, there is an intense struggle for commercial advantage, for strategic advantage, and that plays out throughout this period. That's why the city's founded.
And Jay Gitlin, commerce seems to be the key word in this conversation at this time.
Oh, yes, by all means. This is a place, you know, one of the early nicknames for St. Louis was Pain Court, or Short of Bread. And it was a nickname given to St. Louis because the people in St. Louis, unlike those from surrounding towns in the Illinois country, were not primarily farmers. They were fur traders. They were businessmen. They were actually fur traders who, over the course of the next 30 or 40 years, would begin to diversify their portfolio and get into railroad bonds, the production of railroad iron, real estate, so all sorts of investments. But it's very much a commercial place from the beginning. It's a place for trade. And as Fred pointed out, the native communities all in this whole area are part of that exchange. And so they're critical to the success of St. Louis.
Could you just elaborate for a moment on the role of the Shoto family here? You alluded to that a moment ago with the Madame Shoto. I'm afraid I'm going to be saying Shoto because that's the way.
That's okay. I'll go along with Shoto, yes.
All right. But a little more detail on the role of her in particular and the family.
Well, I think Fred's a little bit more of an expert on this than I am. But she was clearly somebody who was a sharp person. It reminds me of my own grandmother who came over here actually from White Russia as a young person, and she knew how to fend for herself. She was a business person, and she was sharp. I think that's the way Madame Shoto was as well. She understood the value of a dollar. She was somebody who could press a hard bargain, and I think all her children were like that as well, and they had to be. And so they were very, I think, very shrewd is the word I think I've used before. They're very shrewd, and they formed great family alliances for the most part, and they built an incredible extended family enterprise. And another word that I like to use for the building of both St. Louis but of this family that kind of goes together is a French term, which is la maison. So they built the house. You've heard that term before, like the house of Rothschild. Well, this was the house of Shuto, and it was both private enterprise and, in a sense, a public enterprise. It was a business and a family. And they were very keen on extending their range. So they traded with people in Canada. They traded down to New Orleans, and they traded all over the West. So the Shoto name is a name that is well known. you know, up the Missouri River down to Oklahoma and New Mexico. And so they knew how to extend their range, and that's all important for trade. And it was especially important in the fur trade, where one area may die, where the supply of furs may wither after a while. You have to know how to keep extending, how to progress to the next area that has a good supply. Man. But this is Fred's turf.
And Fred is about to tread upon it.
I just wanted to add, Madame Chouteau was so shrewd, she even sued a son-in-law for the loss of a slave. They intermarried with any number of families of different European backgrounds. And then in the great era of the mountain man fur trade, at least five, six, maybe even seven Chouteau cousins were both competing and collaborating with one another. So it's amazing to think that one family could have persevered through so many different ages and stages in the fur trade, with debts, doubts, dangers all over the place. People went belly up all the time, and they survived. And I think that their great strength was the fact that they invested some of that fur trade money, as Jay said, steamboats, railroads, real estate. And while they weren't political powers, I think they remain today pretty influential, whether we realize it or not.
Well, what was the population of the city at that time?
Which time?
At the time we're talking about Madame Chouteau.
Well,
and the early days.
She had seen a great growth from the time she arrived here in September 1764 with a babe in arms and three young children, when the village was 500-600 maybe. Maybe that's even high. And then when she died, 1814, it was probably 4,000 or so.
And to give a sense of scale to this, one of the easy ways to think about the extent of the town, we call it the city because it became one, but it's really a town. By 1800, St. Louis proper covered the space that is roughly now the Arch grounds. Mm-hmm. So that grassy area that seems so small to us now was the town. And I think that's something that Fred, Jay, and I have found ourselves talking about with people a lot, which is when you were asking about the importance of this week, that to many of us, I didn't grow up in St. Louis, but even folks who grew up in St. Louis, they grow up hearing about early America around Boston, Philadelphia, these large Anglo-American British cities that emerged in the 18th century. Well, equally important are these small towns like St. Louis that come into being in the 18th century with a French population among the European population, a very different Indian population in the area, working by very different traditions of language and commerce and trade. And St. Louis is really one of the leading towns of the North American interior, but it's an example of a very different history that most Americans don't know.
I want to move on to some other things, and I have to take a break. But, Fred, let me come back to you with regard to Madame Chouteau once again.
Okay.
How was she regarded? She was unmarried. She had been married in New Orleans, and the divorce was not allowed, as I understand.
Right.
She comes up here. How was she regarded as an unmarried, unwed mother, if you will?
She was
You got that question.
She was regarded as the matriarch of the town, the queen, if you will. And she could have had a so-called common law husband, anybody other than Pierre Clayton, and it would have made a difference. But the officials in New Orleans, when her husband did return to New Orleans, they tried to serve a warrant and get her down river to appear in court. And they had enough strength and enough pull to kind of ignore that, no matter what the Spanish commandant thought.
Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff going on.
Oh, absolutely.
Above and below the surface. I have to take that break now. Let's do that, and we'll continue our conversation about the early days of St. Louis's history as we observe this week the 250th anniversary of the founding of this city. With me in studio, Fred Fowles, from whom you just heard, history professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Peter Castor is with me as well, professor of history at Washington University. And joining us from Yale University is Jay Gitlin. He, of course, teaches history there. Back in just a moment to to continue the conversation. If you'd like to get into it, we'd love to have you. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, and we'll take a tweet at STL on air. What questions do you have about the early days of St. Louis? Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back. We'll continue our conversation on the 250th anniversary of the founding of St. Louis in just a moment. But here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon Newsroom are following today. A Missouri House committee will hear testimony this afternoon from the director of the Department of Corrections about the state's execution procedures. The testimony comes after St. Louis Public Radio and others raised concerns that the agency has declined to identify an out-of-state pharmacy that has been supplying its execution drug. Missouri education officials are digging into proposals for helping the state's struggling school districts. The State Board of Education is holding a special work session today, about a week before the Education Department presents its recommendations. And Illinois Governor Pat Quinn is opening a new Mexican trade office today. He's hosting Mexican officials this week in a follow-up to his visit last year to Mexico. Quinn says it will strengthen business between the two countries, particularly in the areas of agriculture and manufacturing. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation relating to the 250th anniversary of the founding of the city. Historians Fred Faust with me in studio, along with Peter Castor. Fred is from University of Missouri, St. Louis. Peter from Washington University. Joining us from Yale, another historian, Jay Gitlin, where he, of course, teaches history there. I'd like to go right to the phones, gentlemen, because I think a call at Ted raises an issue that I wanted to get to, so let's have him do it. Go ahead, Ted. You're on the air.
I recently finished the restoration of the Tesson House in Hazelwood, which was sold to Shodo in 1804 and remains a Shodo-touched property. In researching that house, I was amazed at the influence that the British had in the growth of St. Louis, where in 1765, everything east of the river was ceded to the British, and the French didn't like that and appeared to come over in great numbers at that point to the new city, and sort of changed it from a trapping warehouse to a major town or village. And I'd like to hear what your experts think about the fear of the British influence that continued up through the attack on the city in 1780 that sort of tied in with the revolution. That's basically my question.
All right, Ted. Thank you so much for the question. Which of you gentlemen would like to take that?
Let me do it.
Yeah, why don't you start with
I'll
that?
Do it. This is Fred. Thanks for calling in. One of the prime reasons for setting up this fur trade monopoly, and it was always assumed that there would be a town. You couldn't have extensive trapping or trading way up to the north of the Mississippi River and extensively up the Missouri River without a town filled with workers, voyageurs, other boatmen, warehouse people to store and pack and ship furs. So that was always assumed as early as 1762, 1763 by the planners in New Orleans. Also, they knew the British were coming. They thought they would send a military occupation force as early as 1763 to Fort Deschartres. They didn't arrive till October 1765, as you noted, but they said the French Catholics will not tolerate living under British Protestant military rule. So essentially, if you've been to Fort Deschartres and you see, you know, what a fine, strong citadel that is, it was the administrative center of all French Illinois. St. Louis replaced that. It didn't have a strong fort of any kind, didn't even have many soldiers, but it administratively, in terms of Indian diplomacy and trade, it replaced it, and so many of the early residents, a vast majority, were from French Illinois. More Canadians than Creoles. And the people that helped build the town, and for many years after, the Canadians outnumbered any other French people in St. Louis.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that you bring up, which is a really good point, is when is there this ethnic tipping point from a mostly Francophone population to an Anglo population? That's really a 19th century development. There's some English settlers who crossed the river in the 18th century. Daniel Boone's the most famous example of that, and he does it mostly because he's run out of Kentucky. He had these dubious, sometimes fraudulent land claims and a legal system that he really disliked, and he came over to, I want to emphasize this, Spanish St. Louis. He sees it as a Spanish colony, even though the population was from the French world. And to get to your point about then how this plays out in the American Revolution, what's so confusing in that is there's a British plan to attack St. Louis, but most of the forces they've got are not redcoats. There are a few British soldiers. There are a few loyalists. But then there's a large Indian force that wants to attack, mostly because of existing conflicts they've got with the Indians who are allied with the Spanish. And the principal Anglo ally, English-speaking ally they've got are Anglo-American settlers under George Rogers Clark. And it's one of these, again, multi-ethnic, multi-racial conflicts that occurs around St. Louis. But there isn't really a large English population to offset this French-speaking population really until the 19th century.
Jay Gitlin is someone who's written extensively about the French presence here. What's your take on all of this?
Well, I would love to add a few fast observations. By the way, I love Peter's phrase, Daniel Boone ran out of Kentucky. That's a wonderful line.
Shattering yet another myth.
Let me just add two things. One is that the French in St. Louis, make no mistake, this was a French place. It was not an English-speaking place. It was a French place. And one of the things that people are always surprised to hear when they ask me what is my field, I tell them it's the history of French North America and places like St. Louis and Detroit. And they're always, really? St. Louis and Detroit are French places? I said, yes, they spoke French on the streets of Detroit until the Civil War. And people are shocked to hear this. So I'd like to point out that the leading French citizens of St. Louis were looking very carefully in the 1770s at what was going on not only in the East Coast, but what was going on in Canada. And in Canada, the British, who were having a very hard time incorporating what is today Quebec into their empire, passed the Quebec Act. And the Quebec Act allowed the French inhabitants of Canada to practice their own legal system, the civil law system, instead of the common law system, at least in civil cases. And it also allowed them to keep being practicing Catholics and to have political rights as Catholics, which was not true back in the British Isles. And so there were a lot of concessions made to the French Canadians. Well, the French merchants in St. Louis were looking at all this, and when the Americans come in and Missouri becomes an American territory, part of the United States, they send a petition and say, look, we want to make sure that we have classes in French, that we have legal proceedings kept not only in English but also in French. They make a number of claims and demands, and they point out that a monarchical country to our north has done that. So certainly the United States can do as well. The other thing I'd like to point out is down in Lower Louisiana, which is Peter's place, they celebrate Andrew Jackson Day on January 11th, and they celebrate, I think, not so much, and this is the Creoles of Louisiana celebrate this throughout the 19th century. They don't celebrate Andrew Jackson Day because they love Andrew Jackson. They celebrate it because Andrew Jackson defeated the British.
All right. Well, that clarifies a few things. A couple of quick questions here just to make sure the audience and all of us are understanding this. Why did the British presence end at the Mississippi River?
Treaty of Paris, 1763. All right. Mid-channel was the international boundary.
Right. Peter, with regard to the size of the village, if you will, the mm-hmm. town, the area now encompassed by the Archer, when did it begin to spread? When did people kind of move out.
Really, 18-teens and 1820s, there's a wholesale migration into the Mississippi Valley from the United States. Variety of factors at work in that. I mean, the largest one was an economic collapse in 1819. A lot of Americans go belly up and move west. But also there's widespread soil exhaustion in places like Virginia, the Carolinas, even in portions of Kentucky. And they come to Missouri, which also at the same time, the federal government is in the process of displacing large numbers of Indians. And so there appears to be abundant land that's cheap for sale, and it's fertile land. So settlers stake their futures in Missouri, and so the population of Missouri grows. And as a result, the population of St. Louis really takes off.
And the role of the Louisiana Purchase in this influx of people, what was that?
Well, the Louisiana Purchase, which was in 1803, is the treaty that formally ceded this vast territory west of the Mississippi, including what is now Missouri, to the United States. So that's sort of a necessary prerequisite. But the large population shift came later, and it took both push from the east and also a pull from the west. It meant settlers had to believe that the federal government was in charge in the place that was Missouri.
Yeah, I might have assumed that the population explosion would begin with that, but that's not the case.
No. Right. And it's interesting that the Virginians under Jefferson and Virginians controlled the presidency for the first 36 years of the new nation, and Virginians compromised Missouri long before the Missouri Compromise and when slavery was legal. Mm-hmm. You know, you get this influx of Virginians and Kentuckians with their slaves.
Well, Jay Gitlin, what was the slavery situation like here then?
Well, Don, first of all, let me just say it's delightful to me to be an audience and listening to my colleagues, Fred and Peter. They're just so bright about all these things and so well-spoken. So I'm very pleased to be a part of all this. One of the things I want to mention about that, by the way, just to go back to the previous question very quickly, St. Louis, the metropolitan region, begins to expand as early as the 1760s. I thought I'd point that out, that I think it's St. Charles is founded. Fred, correct me if I'm wrong, is it 1769?
Yes, that's right.
And Florissant is also founded very early on, as is Vide Poche, or Carondelet, which begins to be a settlement in the 1760s. So there is a growth of the metropolitan region. And to pick up on something Fred said earlier, one of the reasons I think this is the case is that there is a lot of activity and connectedness with French people and Indian people in these what we might call early suburbs of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. So this is a place where there's a lot of cross-cultural exchange of various sorts in these early suburban places of St. Louis. So that grows rather quickly. Now, to get to this last question, one of the things I want to point out, I'm no expert on slavery, but slavery is a part of St. Louis from the beginning. And one of the things that's distinctive about St. Louis, as it is in New Orleans and lower Louisiana, is that many of the people of color in the St. Louis region are French speakers. So that an early mayor of St. Louis named Darby, who comes from Virginia, and he writes his recollections, and he says, when I'm crossing the Mississippi River, he's remembering this as a young child. He remembers that all the Negroes spoke French. And so the people of color in early St. Louis are really also part of this French heritage, and that's true in New Orleans, of course, as well.
You know, I have a question here that comes through Facebook. What role did the Illinois side play in the founding of St. Louis? How did it develop, and why is there no history of the Metro East? Fred?
Oh, there's quite a bit of historical research that's taken place in the last two decades on French Illinois. Carl Eckberg, Margaret Brown, a number of books, both scholarly and popular, define that area as a critical hearth, a cultural hearth of these people that mainly came out of Canada. They were initially squatters who maybe knew the area from fur trading with Indians, and said, gee, you know, the soil is good, better than the lands we can get way away from the St. Lawrence River. So they founded multi-ethnic communities, intermarrying with Indians. They had had African American slave and free, and a lot of Métis, a lot of French-Indian children. And these made the perfect settlers, the people acclimatized to the region, people used to Indian delegations coming in and out of the fort. And so that's what that's why Pierre Laclede founded his – had a first house there to been recruiting these people. Chouteau says that his stepfather really was very tolerant and told the people there's no reason to abandon your homes, your farms. The British are a little more tolerant than you might think. And in his study in St. Louis, Laclede had dictionaries of French, Spanish, and English. So he was quite a linguist.
Were any Indians enslaved?
Oh, yes. Yes. Indian slavery was an accompaniment of the fur trade. It was the second so-called skin trade because it was Indian slaves were trading items. But no Osage slaves were in St. Louis. about 47 Osage were baptized here. But basically, the Osage brought the slaves in. They didn't keep slaves, but they traded them.
That would have been a big mistake trying to move in on the Osage, right?
Yeah.
I have to take another break. Let's do that now. We're talking about the 250th anniversary of the founding of St. Louis. You just heard from Fred Faust, history professor at University of Missouri, St. Louis. Also with me in studio is Peter Castor, professor of history at Washington University, and joining us from studios at Yale, Jay Gitlin. He teaches history at that fine, fine institution. Back in just a moment. We have a lot of calls and some more emails. I want to get to as many as I can when we come back. So let's take that break. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back as we continue our conversation on the 250th anniversary of the founding of St. Louis. Let's go right to the phones and get some input from our listeners. Chris in South St. Louis, go ahead. You're up.
Hi, Don.
Hi.
As your guest mentioned, at its roots, the founding of our city really was, in essence, a commercial enterprise. And the company that was established in New Orleans to facilitate that, the name of that company was Maxent and Laclede, as your guests surely know. But I find it curious, given that Gilbert Maxent, Gilbert Antoine de St. Maxent, I think was his entire name, who was the majority partner of that company. Laclede is the only 25% partner. He provided the financing. I understand he picked all the 30 people that made up the party. You know, he really was the person that made it possible. He's been sort of lost to history here in St. Louis, and I'm wondering if they can comment on that.
Peter, you're nodding.
I think that's a great point. And one of the things, you know, we were talking about during the break, you had asked whether there was a French presence in Illinois, and there certainly was, but for a variety of reasons, residents of Illinois don't choose to remember their French history. St. Louisans have done a wonderful job of doing that. And likewise, why people are remembered and forgotten is hard to tell. And I think a lot of it does belong to the Chouteaus because, you know, Laclede's part of that family. Literally, he's part of the family. And so people pick and choose who they're going to remember and why. And, you know, I wouldn't put money that that's why it happened, but I'd feel pretty confident about saying that's why he's the partner who people remember.
Yeah. Indeed, place is everything. And Maxent is a pretty big deal in Louisiana history, New Orleans history. Yeah. He was fabulously wealthy.
Well, they all shared the same river, and I guess that had a lot to do with it.
And he never came up personally, as far as I know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because to him, New Orleans is the city. I mean, to him, why would I go to this backwater?
Yeah, risk my life.
I'll pay other people to go there.
Well, while we're talking about why people come and go, let's bring in Joe calling from St. Louis. I think he wants to address that. Go ahead, Joe. You're on the air.
Thank you. I've heard that Madame Chouteau came to St. Louis because she had been shunned by society in New Orleans because of some relationship that she had outside of marriage, and is there any truth to that story?
That's the kind of intimate social history that doesn't leave much documentation. So she probably wasn't called out, and it was easier in a polyglot, multicultural city like New Orleans to have, you know, certain affairs or liaisons and so forth. And the reason she came to St. Louis because Laclede and her son were up here. And again, as I said before, here she was the preferred consort of the town leader, let's put it that way. And then her son became the town patriarch when Laclede died in 1778. So nobody was going to comment then. The only criticism of what people assumed who lived nearby here in the 18th century, the only criticism came in the early 20th century, probably about the time they rechiseled Auguste Chouteau's gravestone. Several Catholic priests said that those liaisons could not have happened. They would have Pierre and Madame Chouteau would have been denied the Holy Sacraments. A graduate student of mine, Sharon Person, years ago found the baptismal records when the Chouteau children, as young as 9, 10, 12, stood up as godparents for Indians being baptized. And the priest wrote everything down that happened at the ceremony in great detail. And on this one occasion, Pelagie Chouteau was asked to state her name, and she said Pelagie Laclede. It's in the record in the 1790s.
Jay Gitlin, do you want to get in on the gossip about Madame Chouteau?
John, I don't need to get in on the gossip. I think that's well handled. But I do want to go back to a previous thought about Illinois and just make a claim here. I'll be promotional for just a second and say, to me, one of the most fascinating colonial places in the United States is the Holy Family Church in Cahokia. And its combination of sort of French elements. There's a silver chalice from France, but also of Indian elements. It's one of the great colonial places. And I think people, especially in the East Coast, don't realize how rich the colonial history of Missouri and Illinois is. And there's some wonderful places to see.
And actually, one of the earlier callers is restoring a house, which I just thought was wonderful to hear. Yeah. One of the things very fortunate about in this area, not so much in the center of the city proper, but once you get out of there, there is this French architectural legacy across the river in Illinois, in St. Genevieve, that is just absolutely spectacular.
Some in Florissant,
yeah.
You know, I think there's likely to be a rebirth of that, a renaissance, if you will, as a result of this year, because for the rest of this year, we're going to be talking about St. Louis history, and I think this will awaken some interest in a lot of people. I certainly hope it does. By the way, if you're interested in this conversation, ladies and gentlemen of the audience, this Friday at the Missouri History Museum, all three of these gentlemen will be participating in a day-long event, I guess it is, they'll be talking about just the kind of things we're talking about here. I know that that Jay Gitlin is speaking to the subject, A Great City from the Start, the founding and lasting significance of St. Louis. Fred, what are you going to be addressing Friday?
I'm going to do the early years.
Surprise, surprise. And Peter?
I'm actually going to be doing the later years in the frame of reference to this. I'm going to be talking about Lewis and Clark and the memory of early St. Louis.
Oh, boy, we could go on and on with any of these areas, needless to say. Back to the phones. We're bringing Fred calling from Glendale. Go ahead, Fred.
Don?
Yes, go ahead.
What a neat program.
Isn't it?
You are going to have a hard time topping this for the rest of the year.
We'll see. Go ahead.
Well, what I wanted to ask my question was, I've always been a big fan of the Shaw Garden, now known as Missouri Botanical Garden. And I wondered if Mr. Shaw, number one, he must have been a wealthy man, and I wonder if he had any influence on the landscape and map of the city of St. Louis, more so than just the Shaw Garden.
Does anyone know?
You know, I don't know. I've actually never thought about that. Fred, the caller's name is Fred. You should be able to answer this.
Certainly he had an impact in every sense, in terms of intellectual, scientific impact, real estate for sure, and his personal botanical knowledge, with the help of George Engelmann, a German scientist who lived here, was extensive. What I would like to comment on is, as wonderful as your question is that he came as a young man, late teens, early 20s, just happened to be from Sheffield, England. And he came at the beginning of the mountain man era when they needed tomahawks, hatchets, knives, all the wonderful products of that made Sheffield famous. And with the father and an uncle, he was a recipient of wonderful imported products that made him wealthy from the start.
Timing is everything, isn't it?
Timing is everything. And place.
And he's really a product of a very different St. Louis than this early St. Louis. His is really an antebellum city.
That's right, yeah.
Which had been transformed.
Let's
Don,
go ahead.
I'll add one thing to that, which is that Henry Shaw, one thing I know about him is that he was actually the guy who lent funds to Joseph Robidoux for the founding of St. Joseph, Missouri.
Oh, yeah.
Because at that time, Robidoux couldn't get a loan from the Choteaus, who didn't trust him. And so Robidoux turned to Henry Shaw. So he had an impact on the other side of the state.
And it must have seemed like it was 10,000 miles away back in that particular time.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it did.
Yeah. Let's bring in Frank calling from Fenton. Go ahead, Frank.
Don?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, great show. One of the things I was wondering, I'm a little vague. You guys talk about the Spanish governance of St. Louis at the late 18th century. Now, at the time of the Louisiana Purchase, we bought all of this from the French. Now, what is the timeline on all of that that I'm a little vague on?
It's a confusing timeline. So if it's vague to you, that's perfectly reasonable. It's a great question. So the French ceded this vast colony they had called Louisiana, which went from – and its boundaries were a little vague, but it went roughly from – the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains, from the Gulf Coast to what is now the U.S.-Canadian border. They ceded that in 1760s, basically when St. Louis was founded. They ceded to Spain, and the Spanish send governing officials, but very few settlers. So that's why French remains the day-to-day language in St. Louis during this period. In 1800, the French and Spanish concluded negotiations to restore the Louisiana colony from Spain to France, but Spanish officials would continue to govern. So that's why the French are technically the owners of it. It's why the French are the ones who could sell it to the United States in 1803, but that's why there were still Spanish officials in St. Louis, in New Orleans, up and down the Mississippi River.
Go ahead, Jay.
I'll just add one thing to that. First of all, the treaty is called the Treaty of San Ildefonso in 1800. So France reacquires Louisiana. But a number of years ago, there was an exhibit down in New Orleans to celebrate the Louisiana Purchase, and they had some of the original documents, some of them signed by Thomas Jefferson. And right next to the exchange and the documents signed by Thomas Jefferson were loan papers from a bunch of Dutch bankers because the United States couldn't afford the Louisiana Purchase, so they had to borrow the money from the Dutch.
Wow. And the sale was – the transaction was because Napoleon needed the money to continue the job that he was doing in Europe. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the mortgage we took out, a 30-year mortgage, made the interest payments $28 million instead of $15 million. And Napoleon cashed in right at the beginning and got a loan from, of all things, British bankers to mount an invasion of Britain.
That's right. It's really – it's amazing. And it's actually one of the reasons you'll hear about these – like there's a ceremony in 1804 when the U.S. took charge in St. Louis and – the French are there. The Spanish are there. That's why there's going to be also Spanish representatives this weekend for the 250th anniversary of the city. And that's a history in places like St. Louis and New Orleans. That's the history that people often don't know, this Spanish history that's a very important part of those cities and of this region.
Well, this brings to mind a tweet we received from Robert saying, can your guests talk about any of the differences and similarities between other frontier mission towns? He specifically cites St. Augustine, Florida, where there was some Spanish influence, certainly.
Wow, that was 1565. I mean, that's pretty old and pretty different. That was still the conquistador period. And the Spanish up here in the 18th century were Enlightenment Spanish who really wanted to treat Indians better because of the so-called black legend of mistreatment. But again, you know, the Spanish commandants and a handful of soldiers were most of the people that were Spanish or even Spanish-speaking. And that's why Pierre Alcalde, until his death, was perhaps the main man, maybe the only man, who could speak any Spanish at all. Mm-hmm. And the Spanish commandants complained about that. And wasn't it Meriwether Lewis that brought Jefferson's papers in French, thinking that to be a French governor since 1800? Yeah. The Spanish were always slow. You know, it took them 6 years to send a lieutenant governor to St. Louis, which gave the St. Louisans, mostly French St. Louisans, the chance to form their own society.
Yeah. Plant their roots.
And, yeah, but I mean, one of the freest sites on the whole continent in terms of no priestly pressure, no government pressure, you know, and business as usual.
And I
families.
Think the caller's question about various frontier towns and frontier outposts, it's a great question. And fortunately, we've got Jay here because Jay organized a conference a couple years ago on frontier cities. And I'm just wondering what his thoughts are in response to that question.
Well, a couple of things, Don. First of all, it wouldn't be proper, I think, to call St. Louis a mission town. Mission was not the primary purpose of St. Louis, and it never was. And so the Indians were not here so much to be converted. They were here as partners. They were here as business partners. And that's true for many of the frontier cities that we talked about at that conference that Peter mentioned. It was true in Detroit. It was true in St. Louis. It was true for a number of the places that people from St. Louis later settled, such as Kansas City. So for a number of these French-founded towns in mid-America, they were really more about business. And from the start, they have a kind of almost global consciousness about them. They are very cosmopolitan places because they were all about trade. And so it was all about goods coming back and forth from lots of places, mainly Europe, but even as far away as China. One of the things that gets traded for in the fur trade is vermilion, most of which is sold in little packets. Fred, if I think I have this right, they resembled tea packets, tea bags, and this was red coloring. So if you sometimes see paintings of native people with red face paint, there is a good chance that that red face paint actually came from China.
Absolutely. Just a couple of minutes left. There's so much to talk about, and so many people want to get in. I think we'll have time to bring in. It's either George or Jorge. I'm betting on Jorge. Go ahead.
It's Jorge, Don.
All right.
Yes. Question. I've always been curious to know when the name got changed from Louis, which is indeed named after the French king, to Louis. In the East, they still call it Louis, and the famous movie, of course, Meet Me in St. Louis, wasn't Meet Me in St. Louis. When did it get changed and why?
We've got about a minute left.
19th century. Could I read a very quick quote? Looking at other anniversaries, in 1939, we had the 175th anniversary, and I read a Post-Dispatch article that said, quote, "In 1760, the wilderness stretched north from New Orleans to Canada, where a few savages stamped around. A French fort was built at Chartres to keep off the Spanish from Santa Fe. But the rest of the Mississippi country was like the Congo in Africa." So our historical knowledge has increased a great deal.
Fascinating stuff. We've got less than a minute left. Jay Gitlin, anything you want to add in just a few seconds?
Well, Don, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the sponsorship not only of Yale but of Washington University and of one of St. Louis's very important groups for preserving the history and heritage of this area, and that's Les Amis. And I would like to make sure people understand if they want to find out about the events of this weekend, including the symposium, they can go to www.stl250.org. So stl250.org.
We'll put a link to that on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Just a second or two left. Is Peter, is there any final thought you want to leave us with?
In the second or two less? No. No. I just think it's great that the city – I think this is a terrific opportunity for people to learn about the history of their city.
I think you're absolutely right. And folks can learn more, as already been alluded to, the event at the Missouri History Museum this Friday. All of the guests on today's program will be participating. We'll have information on that as well on our website. Also, a reminder on Channel 9 tonight at 7 o'clock, Jim Kircher's production of Shuto's Journal in His Own Words will be presented. That's a half-hour documentary. You might want to make a note of that. Gentlemen, thank you so much. It's been a great hour.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Tom Herr, head of the New City School, about fostering grit to improve outcomes in educating children. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air, a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Meet us all in St. Louis, folks. I'm Don Marsh.
If you will meet me in St. Louis.